Welcome back to the I'm Not a Pharmacist podcast, hosted by someone like you who's not a pharmacist. Hello, that's me. I'm Jeff Reddick. I once memorized the last six letters of the alphabet backwards. Z-Y-X-W-V-U-T. But I am definitely not a pharmacist. We are sponsored by the Pharmacist Society of the State of New York, PISNY, bringing education on pharmacy issues to the consumer. You can watch us on YouTube and listen wherever you get your podcasts. Episode 3, we're talking about the pharmacies that are not open anymore. Seems like every week we are hearing about another chain pharmacy location closing its doors. But why? From Rite Aid to CVS. We'll talk about all of them. And the answers are not what you think. Now, cannabis and pharmacist wages are also on the docket for this episode. And will anyone ever regulate the pharmacy benefit managers who are controlling your prescriptions like they are the new Amazon.com of pharmacy? We'll break all of that down with our hat-wearing friends, the PBMs. Stick around for the end of the podcast for that segment. Right now, it's time for our first segment. As always, Drug of Choice. Drug of Choice is the definitive quick-hitting news segment in pharmacy land. What's going on in the world of pharmacy right now? First up, Rite Aid closing more stores in New York. This time it's in the city again. AM New York and Patch.com reporting that Rite Aid will close on East 183rd Street in the Bronx and on Hempstead Avenue in Queens Village. And that's after two stores in Brooklyn and one in Flushing announced closures last year. And do you know how many Rite Aid stores are being closed elsewhere, like in upstate New York? In upstate, if you guessed 13, give yourself a sad pat on the back, because Rite Aid filed for bankruptcy in 2023 and has overall announced plans to close more than 430 stores nationwide so far. The company says retail theft and inflation are to blame. But journalists point out that Rite Aid has been named in more than 1,000 lawsuits over opioid-related abuse and deaths. And then, of course, there's the pesky issue of pharmacy benefit managers, making everything harder for every pharmacy out there. More on that in our next segment, of course. We're not done with the chain pharmacy closures just yet, so stick around. Next up in news to absolutely no one, Americans like to use cannabis. Apparently, that's been news to the federal government, though, which has maintained the regulation of marijuana as a dangerous Schedule I drug. But new news this month, the Drug Enforcement Administration has apparently finally changed its stance here and will move cannabis to a Schedule III drug. The good news, pharmacies can dispense FDA-approved Schedule III drugs. The bad news, cannabis is not an FDA-approved drug, and it's not likely to be for quite some time. According to MarijuanaMoment.net and the Associated Press, for cannabis to come to become an FDA-approved drug, rather, it's a whole other process, unrelated to the re-regulation of cannabis that's happening at DEA. And DEA-licensed pharmacies can only dispense FDA-approved drugs, so yes, this is ultimately good news for cannabis users, but don't expect pharmacies to be rolling one for you anytime soon. You will still need to visit a state-licensed medical marijuana dispensary for that. Finally, our friends the pharmacists not doing so hot on the subject of wage growth. Now, this is from new reporting in drugtopics.com. The retail pharmacists in any setting where you pick up your prescriptions at the counter actually made less in 2022 than they did in 2012. That's according to a study from the Journal of the American Pharmacists Association. Hospital pharmacists had it a little better. And interesting to note, actually, the non-pharmacists who work in a pharmacy, like the techs, the pharmacy techs, and the pharmacy aides, saw a jump in pay over that same decade. But retail pharmacists are hurting on the wage side. Guess what that's attributed to in the study? Less competition in the marketplace, because a few large companies are controlling much of the pharmacy industry. That's the analysis in the study. And where have we heard that before? Pharmacy benefit managers. Three of them control 80% of the U.S. drug market. You hear it every episode right here. We will keep talking about it. And that's Drug of Choice. You're listening to the I'm Not a Pharmacist podcast, hosted by me, Jeff Reddick. Definitely not a pharmacist. And that brings us to our next segment. This is A Pharmacist with Heather. I'm still going to mess this up. I always do. Heather, say your last name for me.
Farisi.
Heather Farisi. She's our first rural pharmacist on the pod. She joins us from Bartles Pharmacy, which she owns in Oxford, New York. The best way I can describe how to get there is go to Syracuse and just go south. And just keep going south. Is that accurate?
to
That
say.
is accurate, yes.
But anyways, pharmacy out in sparsely populated areas, excuse me, is its own challenge. And as I understand it, Heather, that's made worse when you have chain pharmacies that close, and they kind of leave you out there on an island as a patient or as a pharmacist. So first off, thank you for joining the pod today. Glad to have you on.
Thank you for having me.
And let's talk about this. You've had two CVS closures near you over the past couple years. How close are we talking to your pharmacy?
Probably about half-hour drive is the closest.
And I would think, a third of our listeners, let's say, have maybe at one point gotten prescriptions from a CVS. Certainly everybody knows about CVS. It's a wildly profitable company. It's on the Fortune 500 list. Why are they closing? I mean, what leads to this constant closure of chain pharmacies by a company that is so profitable?
I think that it's their business model that they identify stores that aren't profitable to them. They are very much motivated by their stakeholders and what they need to do to stay a Fortune 500 company. I see a lot of articles that blame theft and shoplifting and bail reform, but I think that that's just a fancy way of covering up that we have reached a generic plateau where reimbursements are really declining in the pharmacy space. And in order to remain open, each business model has to remain profitable. And unfortunately, even big chains are affected by the decrease in reimbursement and leave an area that is no longer profitable for them.
So what's the gap here when we're talking about pharmacies being profitable? I just told you, CVS as a company is wildly profitable, globally speaking. Pharmacies aren't profitable or are less profitable. Where's the divide there? Because you feel like CVS is profitable, they should be keeping stores open for patient access.
You would think that CVS, being as large as it is, could have a couple of stores that aren't meeting their profitability measurements. I'm not sure what those are from a corporate standpoint. But unfortunately, what happens is they identify those stores, whether they require, 24-hour service. There have been some stores that have to have security guards because they are open 24 hours, and for their staff to be safe in those environments, they have additional expense in the way of paid security guards. Reimbursement in pharmacy has been declining and eroding for years, and there has been some recent changes to our DIR structure and reimbursement methodology that has made it incredibly painful to continue in the pharmacy industry with just continuing to dispense prescriptions. Dispensing typically is not profitable in the pharmacy industry.
I'm going to slow you down. DIR structure. Remember, this is the I'm Not a Pharmacist podcast. So, DIR, what are you talking about if you can make that simple?
I am talking about typically after the fact chargebacks from the pharmacy benefit manager to the individual pharmacy.
Which makes you that you make less money when you get money charged back out of your pocket.
Correct. We might be paid for a claim, a prescription that a patient comes in and picks up. And then, depending on the third party PBM, it might be recouped a year later, 6 months later. So, up until January 1st, when there was a federal change, there was that black box that a lot of pharmacists, I don't think, really realized their true reimbursements. And so what has happened is, as of January 1st, those fees are now taking place at the point of the transaction. So pharmacists are definitely seeing what their true reimbursement is, and it is dramatically different than it had been prior to January 1st.
Even though that money was going out the door prior, you're saying you used to get charged 6 months down the road by your pharmacy benefit manager. Now you're just getting charged right at the point of sale.
Correct. Yes.
So that's pharmacy benefit managers who are charging you. We've talked about pharmacy benefit managers on the pod. Hopefully, that's clear, as unclear as it is. Hopefully that's clear to the listeners. So here's what I don't understand. CVS is in that position where, yes, it's a bunch of pharmacies. It's also a pharmacy benefit manager. So where is that? Again, if they're profitable and they are controlling, it would seem, some level of their profit, how are they closing when it's in patients' interests that they stay open?
it's not in their corporate methodology to remain open. I hate to go as far as to say that they don't care about patient access and patient care, but they definitely answer to their shareholders first. And so the industry itself has to remain profitable. So whether those stores are lower volume stores, maybe they're having some staffing problems and it's costing them a lot of overtime to keep those stores open for various reasons, it just is not worth the time and energy to keep those pharmacies open to continue to serve their patients.
And want to be clear between you and I, you know, this is certainly a pro-pharmacist podcast. There are a lot of good pharmacists, pharmacy techs, aides who work at CVS stores. And they're affected by this, too, when a CVS closes.
That is very much true. There are some wonderful pharmacists working for these large corporations that have experienced vertical integration, and they now are forced to work in unsafe work environments. Their staffing situation is sometimes reported to be unsafe. So there's different issues that face their staff when things like this happen as well.
So let's go to the patient side. You know, a lot of people who are listening to this are going to be patients. When a CVS closes, or a Rite Aid, or a Walgreens, a chain pharmacy, when a pharmacy that's been out there closes in a rural area like yours, what does that do to patients, patient access, patient, you know, ability to get medications timely, in a timely way?
Can really be devastating for the patient, because I think, you know, we've all seen that news article that shows, you know, store closed, you may receive your prescriptions at a different location. But when you're in a rural area such as mine, that might be 40 minutes away. And most people don't have the means in today's economy to be able to make a 40-minute trip one direction to go pick up a prescription, whether it's lack of a vehicle, lack of money for gas, just the time available to get there. A lot of pharmacies, because of this lack of reimbursement, are shortening their hours, which can make it even harder for people who are working to get there before or after work. So it really is a complicated issue.
Let me play devil's advocate again here, because this is the economy we live in now. Mail order, Amazon prescriptions, are those options for people who are out by you?
They definitely are options. It's a circumstance of what type of pharmacy are you looking to get your prescriptions from. Unfortunately, my experience with a lot of mail order pharmacies is that it's incredibly difficult to have simple questions answered. I've had patients report to me that they have waited on hold for over 2 hours just to ask a question about their prescription. And unfortunately, a lot of those patients will tire of that and hang up the phone and call their local pharmacy, chain or independent, and be looking for advice from someone who has not actually filled their prescription, which becomes a liability to the pharmacist answering the questions, because unless we have access to their full patient profile, we're not offering medical advice for someone that we don't have the whole picture. So it can create a dangerous situation for those patients.
Which is not to say you can look at a base situation, Heather, and okay, this is what I think is going on. But what you're telling me, there's value behind being a long time patient or a long time provider for a patient. Can you expand upon that?
Absolutely. Most pharmacies keep patient records going back at least 10 years, so we can have a full profile of every antibiotic that you've received, every blood pressure medication you've ever tried, the dosages, when they were changed, when they were added on. And to be able to have access to that information can be invaluable to not only the patient so that they're aware, but also to their provider. You know, it would be a great world if we all had the exact same primary care provider for our entire adulthood, and that primary care provider was able to take care of us, you know, cradle to coffin. But unfortunately, that isn't today's reality, where people move, they change locations, they retire, whatever their situation is for getting out of the medical industry. It's not uncommon whether you have a new primary care provider, your primary care provider sends you to a specialist. There is not always the communication that the patient believes to be occurring happening between those providers. So your pharmacy oftentimes is kind of the glue that holds all those pieces together. And when people are using multiple or polypharmacy, we lose some of that glue and those bonds aren't as tight as they should be. And it leaves room for potential error, potential drug interactions, potential allergic reactions. It does risk patient care.
Heather, how do you, as the pharmacy, you know, we talked about the options that you offer if somebody calls you, that's not ideal, but proactively, how are you working to, you know, combat or offer another solution for people who don't want to use mail order or delivery pharmacy?
We have not had a reduction in our hours, so I think that just accessibility is really important. Mm-hmm. And I also think that unlike mail order, our pharmacy is able to offer 24/7 emergency services. Oftentimes in rural areas, people will expect the emergency room to be able to provide them with a dose either for that evening and maybe the next morning. But what most people don't realize is that in a rural community, our hospital pharmacies are not open 24/7, so that it's unlikely that the emergency room even has access to the medication overnight. So we do offer 24/7 emergency services to our patients. Something interesting that we also are able to do is we participate in our local rural healthcare organization, or a RIO, where as long as the patient grants us permission, we are able to log into a RIO and be able to see their healthcare information that their doctor's office has uploaded as far as a current medication list, some past medical history, some of their notes. So I think it's just easier for us to go above and beyond and go that extra mile because we aren't being measured by corporate metrics. We're truly there to take care of our patients.
How close, now that you've had this second CVS closure, how close is like the next closest pharmacy to Bartle's Pharmacy?
The next closest pharmacy is approximately 7 miles away.
Okay, so we're talking that could be 15-minute, 20-minute drive, depending on how you got to get there?
Yes. Yep. 15 to 20 minutes.
And then after that, are we talking now you're getting towards bigger cities?
Yes. Now you're looking at probably half an hour to 40 minutes beyond that. Yes.
People who may have run a business or have an idea about running a business, you know, I've never have. I'm sure there's a lot more to it than I know. But the layman would think, well, your competition closed, so you must be doing better. Is that not the case? Can you do as good of a job as a pharmacist if there's fewer of your business around?
We try awful hard. That would be the assumption, is that if our competition is closing, that book of business is coming to what is now a rural small business. The unfortunate thing is that depending on the pharmacy closure and what their demographic and patient population, and unfortunately, sometimes it comes down to the actual medications those patients are receiving, is that the reimbursement is so bad that it will just put you out of business, faster than if you were just maintaining your normal book of business. Before New York State returned to NYRX and moved away from their Medicaid managed care, we actually were in a situation that we were not able to absorb a particular plan from one of our local chains, and those patients were actually harmed very much because mm-hmm. they had a very difficult time receiving their prescriptions.
So yeah, that's not something you can fix, but it makes your job harder to do.
For sure, yes.
Is there like a way to wrap all this up, you know, to help people understand, you know, the damage that it causes when the model changes and patients aren't at the forefront? I don't know if there's an easy way to put a bow on this.
I think it just maybe should motivate those patients to contact their elected representatives and ask the questions, you know, what is going on in this industry so that a Fortune 500 company is leaving my community? You know, I think that a lot of people have different ideas of why they're leaving. But I think that in order for true change to happen, you need to reach out to your elected officials and let them know that this is not good for your health. It's not good for your community. While the chains may be, you know, quote unquote, competition to independent community pharmacy, there's enough business in New York State to go around. I don't think that we're clamoring and fighting each other for specific prescriptions, but I think the industry is in such distress due to reimbursements that patient involvement is critical at this point in time.
Ooh, that's a good transition because we're going into our final segment now. Put on my PBM hat. If you're listening on your phone or an audio device, do click over to the YouTube version, because this is the segment where I get to put on a ridiculous hat and speak as a pharmacy benefit manager. Heather, I know you were looking forward to this today. CVS is one of those PBMs that I am going to be impersonating today. And there, we still had the tag on the hat because it's brand new. So I'm going to ask you to tell our kind listeners at home who aren't watching on YouTube, what sort of hat am I wearing as a PBM today? Can you see it?
Are you a police officer?
I am a police officer. Very good, Heather. I am a PBM police officer. So I am happy today, Heather. Very happy that last year New York withdrew its regulations trying to stop me from running a good business in the Empire State. Heather, New York wanted to tell me, can you believe this? Tell me, an abider of law and order, how I allow you to give certain medications to patients or how I set up your fees and penalties. But you know what, Heather? Luckily, New York is now leaving the policing to me, and I am very happy about that. And we work well together, you and me, right?
Oh, sure. Sure, we work well together. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. I love the hat, by the way, Jeff. But yeah, the PBMs were pretty impressed with themselves that they were able to delay our PBM regulations here in New York.
Well, delay, I think they're just gone, right? Delay is such a strong word. I think we're done with it. Wouldn't you say so? Why would New York try again?
I think that you would, as a PBM, want to be done with it, but organizations like PISNI are really adamant. We're working with New York State Department of Financial Services, also known as DFS, and we currently are in a comment period to bring about our PBM regulations and get those back on track so that the cops of the PBMs, unfortunately, are not above the law and will have to abide by New York State regulation, is our hope.
I wouldn't call it so much above the law, Heather, as I am the law in the pharmacy space. Well, think about this. I do such a good job creating rules and laws in the pharmacy space that so few states even try to regulate me. So clearly, I'm doing a good job. Wouldn't you agree?
Probably show you a couple of patients that would disagree with the management that they've been receiving from their PBM.
I could show you a couple of shareholders who would disagree with you, but continue.
I bet you could. Some of them might be our elected officials, by the way. So it's one of those things that PBMs came into play as an administrative process. They were never meant to have the power that they have. They found a really niche position in this industry and have made billions and billions and billions of dollars. So I can completely understand you would not want to be regulated anywhere in the 50 United States.
I would just like to hear, Heather, what are some of your favorite rules and laws that I've made is what I really want to hear from you.
Oh, where to begin? Where to begin? There are so many. One of my personal favorites is that your regulation that an expected mom who is not quite 18 years old is not entitled to prenatal care in the form of prenatal vitamins. So, you know, that's one of my personal favorites.
I mean, you can get them anywhere, Heather.
Yeah. That's an easy fix. Sure. You know, the patient who just had, you know, open heart surgery is in need of a anticoagulant in a timely fashion because they're being discharged at 6 o'clock in the evening and I can't get a hold of the doctor that discharged them and you're saying that they can't have it. I have to turn around and send them back to the emergency room. That's another one of my favorites because I feel that that's really cost effective to do.
Well, but you know, one thing that we have in common there is I think we have heart. So there's that. The word heart, at least, is in there. Heather, as a PBM, I know New York's regulations that were proposed and thankfully withdrawn really would have hurt our relationship between you and me. And look, because I wear the hat in the relationship, I was able to make sure that New York didn't do that. So first of all, you're welcome. And second, would you like me to wield some influence again? Because I know New York's talking, maybe we're going to bring these regulations back. I am willing for our relationship to make sure that they don't bring any regulations back on me.
Oh, well, thank you for being so considerate, but I really, you know, I don't need your help in that area of my life at this stage. We are working very diligently with DFS and New York State, and that is something that we anticipate very shortly will be brought back. We are a little disappointed, but still enthusiastic about the new proposed regulations and our relationship with DFS, that this will just be the tip of the iceberg. And once we are able to start doing some data collecting on those fantastic practices that you have for saving patients money and efficiencies in the pharmacies, that it will all work out the best for all of us. So thank you.
Heather, if New York decides to do that and regulate us PBMs, can we at least keep the hat?
Oh, absolutely.
Thank you.
Keep the hat.
Heather Parisi, thank you so much for joining That Crazy Segment and the I'm Not a Pharmacist podcast. It's really been a pleasure having you.
Well, thank you for having me.
And that's I'm Not a Pharmacist, episode 3. I'm Not a Pharmacist is a monthly podcast written, researched, and produced by the team at Baker Public Relations of Albany, New York. We are supported by the Pharmacist Society of the State of New York. Find us on YouTube to watch the show and listen wherever you get your podcasts.